looking at me. Okay, now we got to start all over.
They good. Don't need the review. They can just go back to the recording from last week.
Yeah. All right. But we still have to do the good morning. Good morning, class. It's so good to see everybody. You're my favorite people, and you brought joy and sunshine to me today. How is everybody? Good morning.
Right up until his computer gives him a pop-up. And the joy and sunshine ends.
Yeah, that's all he needs. Update now. You will update. You will not go. You will not pass go. You will not collect $200.
Yeah. That was pretty decent.
What was?
That whole introduction. That was
nice. It's a softer side of me. A lot of people don't see often. All right. Nero sat at the throne of a very early stage of Christianity. This would be from 54 to 68. So this would be roughly from the Acts chapter 18 to the end of the book. And unlike other emperors who came after him, he did not persecute Christians for refusing total allegiance to him or worship or anything like that. That whole concept had not yet really evolved, and where it was mandatory. And even if it had been required, Romans at this period would have given the Christians an exemption because they were, why was this exemption? Going back from last week?
They were a sect of Judaism.
Yeah, they just saw them as part of the Jewish sect, and Jews enjoyed a certain exemption that we talked about last week. So on the night of June 18, AD 64, there's this great fire that broke out in Rome. How many are familiar with the story? I think you probably have heard bits and pieces of it or heard it at some point. The fire lasted several days. It destroyed 10 of the 14 sections of the city. So this is pretty significant. This would be Rome. And it was rumored that Rome had set the fire himself. We don't know for sure, but this is the prevailing rumor. And he did this so that he could watch Rome burn. And the bright spectacle of such a grand and glorious city blazing in fire that would inspire him to write a great epic poem, because he fancied himself as a great artist. And it is reported that he watched the fire from the top of a tower. He dressed up as an actor. He played his harp, and he sang about the destruction of the legendary city, Troy. And accusations started coming his way that he was responsible for all this. So he did what a lot of dictators do, even including what we see today. He tried to transfer the blame somewhere else. And two of the areas that had not burned had a large population of Christians. So he found himself a convenient scapegoat. And he had them arrested, and they were convicted. And some of these were crucified, and others were thrown to the lions. And a number of them, this is very disturbing, were burned alive in his gardens at night. And he would say to them, "So you want to be the light of the world? Here, light up my gardens." And it was noted by witnesses that persecution didn't appear to be, you know, like a satisfaction of justice as it was so much to provide an amusement for Nero, because he was just this demented, twisted guy. And he did enjoy bizarre circus exhibits, and he just considered this as entertainment along the same line, watching Christians burn, being fed to the lions, and that sort of thing. So we're not certain how long this particular wave of persecution lasted. We're fairly certain it was just confined to the city of Rome itself. And it was during this persecution that we talked about two martyrs from last week, two famous people from the New Testament. It's reported that they were martyred during this time. That would be who in Rome?
Stephen.
Who?
Stephen.
Well, no.
No? Sorry.
Under Nero?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Paul and Peter. Okay, all right. And after Nero, we have about a 10-year period where Christians are generally ignored by the authorities. So this brings us now up to around 81, where we have Domitian, and he assumes the throne. And the temple had been destroyed, as you know, in the fall of Jerusalem. This would be 11 years early or so. And he sees here an opportunity. You know, all that money that the Jews had been given to keep the temple, you know, maintained and up, all the upkeep and all that, where is that money going? And so his wheels start turning, and he orders the Jews to pay that same amount to his imperial treasury. And how do you think the Jews responded? From what we've known so far in the previous two classes, they have a history of complying or not complying when these sorts of things happen. They don't comply very well. And they did not this time. And as a result of the stubbornness, Domitian ordered the Roman authorities to crack down on anyone who followed Jewish practices. So this began a new persecution. It was directed toward both Jews and Christians. And here, Christians had nothing to do with it, but because they were identified as part of the Jews, then they got in on the punishment. So Domitian, he's a true tyrant. He is the first emperor to officially demand that he be called Lord and God. So it's with him that we start this whole thing of emperor worship for sure. And he ordered citizens to hail his greatness with acclamations like Lord of the Earth and God the Lord. And those who refused were punished, and it is under this persecution that John writes the book of Revelation while exiled on the island of Patmos. And like Nero, Domitian was known for being cruel, sick, and twisted, and his favorite amusement was to watch gladiator fights between dwarfs and women. So it tells you a little bit about the weirdness going on in him. All right, the next emperor is Trajan. This would bring us now to his reign was like from 98 to 117. And as we enter the second century now, emperor worship has been firmly established. And in 111, a well-known Roman official named Pliny the Younger, he was appointed the governor of Bithynia, which would be in modern-day Turkey. And there he had to deal with an unexpected problem. There were so many Christians in that region that the pagan temples were almost deserted. And the market for sacrificial offerings used in those temples was suffering severely, and the economy rested on that. And Pliny knew that Christianity was illegal. He was concerned about the effects of this illegal religion that it was having on the economy, and he saw the advantage of just cracking down on them. But as history books tell us, he was a fair ruler. He wasn't twisted and cruel like others before him. He was upright and just, and he wasn't eager to bear the sword unnecessarily. So he has some hesitation here, and he writes to the emperor for a clear policy on the matter. So this is Pliny the Younger writing to Trajan the emperor. And he asks, what are we to do with the Christians? Do we have an official policy here or not? Are we to actually enforce this law, or do we let it go? What kind of tolerance can we give? Would you have me hunt them all down? Or perhaps just the leaders, how much resources are we to put into this? And then he asked, besides their stubbornness, because they were known to be stubborn and not refuse in their refusing of the worship of the emperor, he wanted to know what other crimes really have they committed. And so Pliny noted that he believed them to be harmless except for the effect that they were having on the economy. So Emperor Trajan writes him back, and he establishes a policy. And this is important to us because this is known as Trajan's policy, and it becomes the law of the land that emperors after him will follow for the next 100 years, for the next century. It's the standing law of the land. And Trajan ruled that the authorities should not waste time and resources chasing Christians down. It's not worth it. But if they are accused, they are to be given the opportunity to worship the gods and the Roman emperor, and if they don't, then they are to be punished. So it's kind of like a don't ask, don't tell sort of policy. There's not to be any anonymous accusations. There is to be a full pardon. Part of this policy said that there's to be a full pardon if they do worship the image of the emperor. They did not specify what the punishment was, so that would be left up to the Roman authorities in that region. And again, this became the standing law of the land for the next 100 years. So a church leader, Tertullian, which we'll talk about more next week, he was quick to point out how illogical and contradictory this policy was. He said, the fact that you don't hunt them down indicates that they haven't done anything wrong. And if they haven't done anything wrong, then why do you punish them? So this brings us now to Marcus Aurelius. He's a kind of a well-known emperor, even outside of Christian circles and history books. He reigned from 161 to 180, and he was nothing like Nero or Domitian or others who were full of themselves and thrived on glory and power. He was a refined man. He was a kind man. He left behind a collection of meditations written for his own private use, and that became a masterpiece of literature of that day. And in these, he praised virtues like human dignity and kindness and justice, and he condemned the rebellion and hypocrisy and so on. And in his writings, we find the common cliche that is used to this day. You hear it all the time. Undertake every action in your life as if it were the last. You ever heard that one? Yeah, so that began with him. So under such an emperor, you would think that Christians would enjoy a period of peace and maybe even support. And indeed, in his writings, he praises the Christians for their willingness to die for their convictions. He admires them. But nonetheless, he condemns them for their just what he calls illogical stubbornness. Why are they so illogical? And though he was considered to be an enlightened man, he was, however, this is the part two of his character, he was very superstitious. And he sought the advice of astrologers and seers and mystics and all this before any significant undertaking. So during his reign, unfortunately, the empire suffered from numerous invasions and floods and plagues and disasters and all sorts of stuff. And his occultic advisors told him that this is because of what? Christians. They're the ones to blame for this. They had invited the wrath of the gods for refusing to worship them and the emperor. And therefore, in order to appease the gods, the Christians would have to submit. And Marcus Aurelius went along with this advice, and he ordered for the severest, this is the severest outbreak of persecution up to this point. And there is a record of Christians being held in a prison that was so crowded that they actually died of suffocation before the executioners could get to them. So this is all part of appeasing the wrath of the gods, is to punish the Christians, make them suffer and die. And this persecution came upon the church so quick and was so unexpected that unfortunately many fell away from the faith. They were not prepared for this. They had not been given the kind of instruction and exhortation you need to be ready for this sort of thing. And the church leader, Irenaeus, that we'll talk about again next week, he referred to this sudden and harsh attack upon Christians like he used the words like a bolt of lightning. It just came out of nowhere, and it was so severe and so harsh. And in regards to those who caved in, Irenaeus said, quote, some of them weakened and left the womb of the church like a miscarriage. So quite a picture here. And Irenaeus himself died as a martyr under this emperor. So though in principle Marcus Aurelius followed Trajan's policy, he pushed it further than what it had been intended, especially when it came to hunting them down. He found a way to work around that. Though Rome did not necessarily search out Christians, Aurelius did offer a reward for those who would turn them in. And what do you think that reward might have been? So you've got your neighbor, you know he's a Christian, and you're being enticed to turn them in. They're given a choice now to either worship the gods or die. And many of these Christians are going to cave in, but some of them are going to choose death. So what do you think, put two and two together, what do you think the reward is for turning in a Christian who refuses to worship and dies? They get their property. That nice home, that nice garden, that nice Porsche in the garage, you know, that swimming pool, all that stuff. That could be yours. All you have to do. What's that?
The Soviets were known to do the same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Turning in people.
Yeah. So that's probably where they got the idea from. Or they were just, it's just a common thing being it's deviant. Yeah. All right, but so that we don't think too bad of him, he wasn't all that bad of a guy, Marcus. He also sent orders that confessing Christians who were Roman citizens, when it came to their time of death, they got the privilege of being beheaded. So that was a less painful way to die, and that was better than being thrown to the lions or that sort of thing. So see, he's kind of really is a nice guy after all. Okay, Septimius Severus. This brings us to 193, and he reigns until 211. He's the last one we'll look at this time, and then in part two, when we pick this up again, we'll look at the emperor's waves of persecution during the 3rd century. All right, at first, Christians were able to live in peace under his reign. In fact, he even entrusted the rearing of his son to a Christian nurse. This sounds promising, and it is reported that he had members of his family who were believers. That sounds promising. However, again, the empire had suffered from another series of violent civil wars within the border. And this unrest, he believed, could be resolved if there was unity among the citizens. And what better way to bring people together than to unite them in what way? In religious harmony, okay? So his agenda was to bring all of the citizens, all of the subjects of the Roman Empire together under the worship of the unconquered sun, S-U-N. And this would be the unifying force in Rome, a merging of all religions into one. And this new religion, it would accept the worship of all these other gods, but worshipers had to acknowledge the sun and had to acknowledge that the sun reigned over all. Again, S-U-N. Okay, so as you can imagine, the Jews and the Christians were not willing to comply with this. And in order to stop these two monotheistic religions, monotheistic meaning, Aiden, what's monotheistic?
Multiple gods.
Polytheistic would be multiple gods. So monotheistic would be worship of...
worship of multiple gods.
Now you're thinking backwards. I caught you off guard. So Christians and Jews were monotheistic, which means that they worship one God. Okay. So in order to stop the spread of these two monotheistic religions, Septimius outlawed under penalty of death all conversions to either Christianity or Judaism. And this was in addition to the still existing threat of Trajan's policy. And history records for us that it was during this time when martyrdom was actually romanticized. You may have heard about this. This was because church leaders, of course, exhorted their congregations to remain faithful, and this might have been part of that pep talk, setting an example of others, but Christians would greet each other on the streets, "May you gain your crown," and highlighting the honor of martyrdom, the crown of life that's promised to those in Revelation about those who persevere and die for the faith. The anniversaries of martyrs would be observed, and they would be called their birthdays, referring, of course, to the time that they were truly born in the kingdom of God because they'd given their life for the Lord. And in fact, it got to be to a certain point that bishops would have to often restrain zealous Christians who wanted to do what? Yeah, who wanted to rush into the roar of the fire prematurely, and it wasn't really called for. And so there was a problem of that. So persecution, of course, it continues now through the 3rd century and the first part of the 4th century, and we'll pick it up from there maybe this fall. So any questions about this, about that? So Christians do respond to some of this, and continuing with the handout, we have those during this period, a number of what we call apologists. This is where it actually first starts. These were Christian intellectuals of the day who would present a case to the Roman government defending Christianity, begging them to show some tolerance, leniency, back off. It's not serving your purposes to persecute believers. And we don't know if any of their arguments had any effect or not. It may have. We don't know. Maybe with certain emperors. And we don't know even if the emperor ever received these, but these were written and sent to him. But they do give us insight into how the early Christians responded to hardship. So several different arguments were fashioned. The first one, most of the apologists tried to correct the numerous rumors and false accusations about Christians. We did not hate Rome. And they had to constantly struggle against that. Here is what our religion teaches about that. Here are examples in our practices that prove it. And they would, you know, give out a litany of their good works in the community. And here are the verses that say that we are to honor the king and we're to do good to mankind and that sort of thing. All right, number two, along those lines, some would try to persuade the emperor that Christianity was a peaceful religion, not one that Rome should be threatened by. "Our kingdom is not of this world," was a common expression, "and we have no desire to revolt." A third argument is that we do love our fellow citizens, we care for the poor, we take in abandoned babies, we work hard and do not mooch off of others, we pay our taxes, we are good for society, and they would refer to actual examples of this and to certain scriptures that direct them to live that way. And then number four, others argue that persecution was ineffective and should be discontinued, that it had instead just the opposite effect of what Rome was intending. Tertullian wrote, "The more you mow us down, the fuller the harvest, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." So he tried to argue it from that perspective. And why would persecution have the opposite effect? Why was it that the blood of the martyrs became the seed of the church? You would think that non-Christians would look at these Christians being killed and say, what in the world? These people are so crazy, I want nothing to do with that. But how could persecution serve the purposes of evangelism?
Just like the disciples going to their deaths, there's a thought, there's nothing false in what they believe.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Josiah.
I was going to say it's twofold. Like when she said they saw Christians actually living out their faith first.
Yes.
And then they're also willing to die for it.
Yeah.
So principles and precepts that the apostles taught the early Christian church continue. And then when their time came to be martyrs, they willingly went.
Yeah. The claims of Christianity compared to the claims of these polytheistic deities and all of this is strikingly different. And now you've got followers of the Son of God who are living in such a, you know, hopefully dedicated way, willing to die for what they believe to be true. That has to have a startling effect. People take notice of that. All right, very good. So, by the end of the second century, historians have projected that there were 2 million believers at this time. That's quite a lot. 2 million believers in just less than a couple hundred years of the faith, 150 years or so. All right, so number five. Others would argue that the idols of the other religions, including the gods of the realm, were not real. They would appeal that way. They were just made of man. They had to be maintained by man. They had to be protected by man. What kind of a deity is that? And they would argue that way. And then Justin Martyr, he's a brilliant man, but in many ways he's kind of known in history as having kind of a bit of a testy attitude. So he took a different approach. He promised the emperors that God's judgment would fall on them if they did not repent from their persecutions and from this merciless slaughter of the Christians. So that was his argument. And now we know why he is called Justin Martyr, because that argument did not win favor. All right, number seven, last one. And then there was this argument, which is actually probably my favorite, and I've talked about it in a couple sermons in the past, and that is, what is best for the empire? What is best for the emperor himself? And they wrote, and here's a quote, "Except for worshiping the emperor, we are loyal citizens of the empire. What the emperor needs is not to be worshipped, but to be served. And those who serve him best are those who pray for him and for the empire to the only one true God." So that was a great argument. All right, any questions about that before we move on to heresies? That completes what we want to talk about regarding persecution. So we started that last week with reasons Christians were persecuted, why Christians were initially exempted because they were seen as a sect within Judaism, and then persecution under specific emperors, and then how Christian leaders responded with their arguments to religious authorities. Yes,
sorry,
Amanda.
I was busy writing 2 million Christians. Can you tell me what number five was again?
Okay. I'll have to look it up.
Idols of other religions are not real.
The idols are not real. They were made by man. They're maintained by man. They're protected by man. What kind of a deity is this? Come on, you guys. Use some common sense. This is stupid. They may not have said that, but that was the thought. Okay, second century heresies. So now we need to review just a little bit of Gnosticism. We're not going to try to cover everything that we talked about before. But what do you remember about Gnosticism? It's like a combination of three ingredients. Remember what those ingredients, the driving force behind it is what? A philosophy known as
Platonism.
Okay. And then you add to it elements of
Christianity,
especially about Jesus being the light. And then you add other elements from Jewish or Eastern mysticism. And so there's going to be different streams are going to have different combinations of this and all of that. So let's talk about Platonism again at the risk of wearing you out with it. Just in a nutshell, somebody give me some of the takeaway points about Platonism.
Matter is bad.
Matter is bad. We've got this dualistic approach to the universe. That which is in the unseen is good. That's where all moral virtue is. Matter is bad because it's a corruption of the true and the real. Okay. Anything else? This means that creation is not good, and that there is no incarnation, and that the resurrection of the dead would be a bad thing. That's its conflict with Christianity, because the whole objective is that we are imprisoned in these bodies, and death releases us from that. So Gnosticism, it just infiltrates Christianity here in the early years. It's a great threat. It's probably a greater threat than even persecution. And the body becomes useless, so there's two different avenues it takes. One is to deny its appetite and to bring it into subjection, and by doing so you become more spiritual. And the other one is it doesn't matter one way or the other, so it's more like a hedonistic lifestyle. Live free, eat, drink, and be merry, and don't worry about it. And all right, so we looked at, last week we saw that it had lodged itself in, we looked at Ebionism and Docetism. What can you tell me about Ebionism? They denied
his true deity.
They denied his true deity, that the Christ inhabited this man Jesus at his baptism and then left just seconds before Jesus died on the cross. So Jesus was kind of like possessed by the eternal Logos. And then Docetism, they took the other approach. They did not deny his deity. They denied his humanity. And they said that Jesus was basically a phantom. Okay. And you can always remember this because just think footprints in the sand. He didn't leave any when he walked. He just appeared to be human. All right. So as we come into the middle part of the second century, we have several Gnostic teachers and groups, but two become quite popular and they stand out in church history books. And we have Valentinus and Marcion, both of whom had established large followings and become quite prominent. And both were kind of anchored in Rome or started in Rome. And though many church leaders resisted their teaching, there were two church fathers whose names often come up in opposing them. And this would be Tertullian and Irenaeus. And we'll talk more about them next week, but because they come up today, I'll just give you a couple comments about them, and we'll flesh it out more next week. Tertullian would be in Carthage. This would be in North Africa. He had a brilliant legal mind. He was probably being trained as a lawyer. He used logical arguments to refute heresies, and including Gnosticism. And he was a very black and white kind of guy. He hated any lukewarmness at all in the church, whether that would be accommodating heresies or living compromised lifestyles and not rebuking sin and that sort of thing. And to this day, we use many of his concepts in helping us understand the Trinity and the two natures of Jesus. And because he was one of the first really sharp theologians of the early centuries, he is often referred to as the father of Western theology, of the Latin-speaking church. And Irenaeus, on the other hand, he was certainly a bright guy, but he wasn't really known to be an intellectual. He's primarily known for his deep compassion and desire to see the church be healthy and pure and unified and Christians growing in their faith. He had a real shepherd's heart, and he saw God primarily as a shepherd, a loving being who created the world and created human beings, not out of any necessity nor out of mistake, like the Gnostics claim, but out of a desire to have a creation to love and to lead, like the shepherd who loves and leads his flock. And so he was quite skillful in using this particular argument as to refute Gnosticism, which is very plain and simple and to the point. So we'll start now with a summary of Valentinus. And we have this prestigious school in Alexandria that trained the clergy for ministry. It's kind of like the intellectual hub that drew in Christian thinkers and theologians. You remember, where is Alexandria again? Okay, it's in Egypt. It's in North Africa. Valentinus actually taught there, and he had a reputation for being a brilliant theologian, so he's like in the middle of this intellectual hub. And the school, however, was known for, and this prevails through church history, starts very early on, but it goes into several centuries. They has a history for teaching, who wants to guess, what kind of method of interpretation when it comes to hermeneutics? They really like the starts with an A, the allegorical interpretation. So there's symbolism in everything. They weren't really that big on just the plain straightforward meaning in how it was originally intended. They were looking for all these deep secrets. And so they were big into that, and Valentinus, of course, subscribed to all that. So in about 136, he moved to Rome. He quickly became the favorite candidate for a highly admired position as Rome's bishop. And not only was he not appointed to that office, but he would later be excommunicated from the church for heresy. And Tertullian claims that Valentinus was so angry about the rejection of not getting the position as bishop of Rome that he formed his own version of Christianity just to be spiteful. We don't know if that's true, but that's what Tertullian wrote. So shortly after Valentinus' death, Irenaeus began the massive work named On the Detection and Overthrow of the So-Called Gnostics. Kind of an interesting title. And the first half of the book is that of refuting the teachings of Valentinus. So let's look at these. They're very bizarre. It's a little hard to follow. And so I'm going to try to simplify it here. And it will seem, at least to us, to be just ridiculous. Like, how in the world can anybody come up with something this crazy? And keep in mind that, you know, that ideas are the product of the times that you live in, and this all made good sense to people that were steeped in Greek culture and Platonism, this sort of thing. And it was kind of like maybe the same way that those in the second century would look at us today and wonder, how could the church ever look like a rock concert? You know, that is so bizarre. What are they thinking? Or how could Christians ever support the LGBT agenda? That's just so bizarre. Or not oppose abortion, and so on. So equally unbelievable. So again, we are products of our times. So being a Gnostic, Valentinus had to come up with a way to explain how creation came into being. He has to do this because, again, creation is bad, okay? And he who is the supreme good is not responsible for it. That's how we have to begin there. And to do this, he took some of the concepts that Plato taught about the structure and hierarchy of the unseen world and used that as a framework for his own elaborate scheme. So again, I'll present this as a kind of streamlined version. You have at the top a single, transcendent, and utterly unknowable being existing alone, God, the supreme good. And he cannot be known. He's totally transcendent. So what do we mean by transcendent? We have that in our offering slides every year. We go through it. What are we emphasizing about God when we say that he is transcendent?
His separateness from creation.
Yeah, he's separate from creation. He's not. That's contrast to pantheism, which teaches that God is part of creation. He's separate. He's the creator, so he's above and beyond it. So if you push that too far, then you're going to end up with problems like this, because at the same time, the counter to God being transcendent is that God is also immanent. He's involved in creation. All right, so anyway, let's get back to this. He alone, the supreme good, existed for countless ages just by himself. Eventually, he emanated other entities. Okay, so emanation is just simply like it issues out of, it flows out of you. It's produced out of you, it proceeds from you, it's derived. It's kind of like water from a spring. It's not really birth, it's not really produced, it's emanated. Who then, after countless ages, emanated other entities themselves, who are a little less than the emanations that they emanated from, all right? And these are called eons, right? And then through countless ages, they emanated other eons, right? And so on. And each generation was a little less pure and a little less perfect than the one before. It's kind of like taking the original, putting in a copy machine, making a copy, putting that back into the thing, and then making a copy of the copy, and a copy of the copy of the copy of the copy, and so on. Eventually, you have 30 divine beings, eons. They're produced, each representing Christian virtues like truth, understanding, goodness, love, patience, responsibility, mercy, that sort of thing. And together these eons complete the heavenly world, the unseen, perfect thing that Plato always talked about. And they were the totality of divine powers and divine goodness. And this is called the Pleroma, and which simply means fullness. Okay? So the last, everyone following so far? This is pretty simple up to this point. the last eon was wisdom, and she was the weakest of all, Sophia. And she, desiring to know the unknowable Father, because she just had this, there has to be a way to know the unknowable Father, the supreme good. She fell into darkness of despair. She just emotionally couldn't handle it, not knowing who the supreme good was. And in her distress, she produced a premature and malformed entity called the Child of Chaos. And the Child of Chaos, being imperfect itself and the result of an imperfect origin, was expelled from the Pleroma. So no longer part of the of that which is the good supreme totality of divinity up above, right? And once outside the Pleroma, what do you think it did? Yes, it did cause chaos because it made physical matter. And this explains why physical matter is inherently evil. Evil comes from an inferior, flawed creator known as the Child of Chaos. In fact, the actual technical name was Demiurge. All right, so Valentinus also proposed an elaborate plan to explain salvation and how Jesus Christ fits into all that. So typical of 2nd century Gnosticism, he believed that Jesus was a man that the Christ inhabited in order to teach mankind spiritual insights. And so again, salvation, according to Gnosticism, is not the result of atonement, but the result of enlightenment. And it gets even stranger, so don't bother to take notes from this point on. I think I have a handout that kind of gets into this. Wisdom also produced another offspring called the Workman. And the Workman gave shape and form to this matter and brought about the ordered world of earth, sky, sun, animals, rocks, people, and so on. And so the Child of Chaos just made matter, but the Workman brought it all together and made an actual world out of it. And when Wisdom saw what had happened and what she had done to cause this, she just grieved even more. I mean, if things were a mess emotionally before, now it's even worse. It's bad enough to be responsible for physical matter, but now she is responsible for a whole fake world that is inhabited by living beings, a counterfeit of the true and the real, a counterfeit Pleroma, a corrupted version, a fake universe. And so Wisdom was filled with regret and remorse. What have I done? How can I fix this? And all the other eons in the Pleroma, they grieved with her as well, and they called upon the eons named Understanding and Truth to help her. And they then produced two other eons named Christ and the Holy Spirit to rescue Wisdom from her sorrow. Is this getting a little bit bizarre at this point?
Is the Supreme Good the Father?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know that they would refer to him as that, but probably. The eon Christ united himself to the man Jesus in order to teach mankind the saving knowledge about their origin and destiny. Again, Gnostic knowledge. And those who receive this knowledge are the chosen. And they are the ones who have sparks of divinity still, like residual sparks of divinity residing in them from all that's transpired up above. So some humans still have these little bits of divinity in them and others don't. That's kind of like left over. Does that make sense? So those who still have those sparks of divinity in them, they respond to the message of enlightenment that Jesus brings. And at their deaths, these are the ones who will be freed from the evil matter, which includes their bodies. And they will return to the Pleroma once they receive their spiritual existence because they have those sparks in them. And in the end, when all living things have died, the physical world will be given order to utter destruction and disorder. So again, Jesus saves people not because he atones for the sins, but because he gives them the secrets of enlightenment. The disciples have these secrets. The apostles, they have passed them down to others from generation to generation. They are not, however, found in these secrets are not found in any of the New Testament documents. It's a separate body of knowledge apart from the scriptures. And those who have the secrets are the children of the kingdom, and they will, again, enter the Pleroma upon their death. So The teachings of Valentinus, though they are bizarre to us, they made sense to those who were influenced by Greek thinking. And this idea of the pleroma consisting of spiritual entities that represent virtues is similar to what Plato proposed. And as a result, Valentinus, who also enjoyed a lot of respect and standing with many church leaders, because again, he had a prominent place of teaching in that school in Alexandria, he ended up getting quite a following to all this. And several of his faithful students started their own schools. And his teachings flourished well after he died toward the end of the second century, and perhaps even longer. All right, any questions about Valentinus? How many find any of that, like, wow, that's kind of cool. I think I'd like
to
know.
Do you think he really believed it, or he was just doing it to be spiteful?
Historians kind of think that Tertullian was just reacting, that he really did believe this stuff and he wasn't just being spiteful. But it is interesting to note that he was very upset about not getting the bishop, and he may have been inspired this way. I don't know.
That certainly would have been consistent with the sort of Neoplatonic thought. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's consistent with Neoplatonic thought today. I had a professor at IPFW who was a Neoplatonist and would openly proselytize for all of us to become Neoplatonists, but he was of the opinion that you could just merge it with whatever you already were and then that would be fine.
Just make some adjustments here and there.
Yeah.
Slight tweaking. Yeah. It just seems like, yeah, you know, polytheism with extra steps, you know, with the whole eons.
Well, they didn't worship the eons.
I get that, but it seems like for appealing to a pagan ideology, it's like a transitional form, if you will, to Christianity. It just seems like it was polytheism with an extra step that led to Christianity, you know?
Well, keep in mind, though, how complicated the polytheistic schemes of that time were. This would probably actually have been fairly simplified compared to, like,
the
Roman the conceptions of their gods and the Greek.
That's another element to this, because those civilizations would have had weird structures and all that in the unseen world. All right, let's move on now to the next guy. The next dominant Gnostic teacher of the second century was a son of a bishop, and he was named Marcion. And he of course, grew up in a Christian home, knew Christianity from an early age, and he joined the church in Rome. He made a very large financial donation to it. He was a wealthy man, well-established. And he was later excommunicated for heresy, and the church gave him back every dime of his donation. He said, "We don't want you. We don't want your teachings. We don't want your money. Go away somewhere and die." Okay. So like the other Gnostics, Marcion was convinced that the physical world is bad, should have never happened, and like Valentinus, he ended up with the same conclusion. The Creator himself is to blame. The Creator is flawed. But Marcion had a completely different scheme to explain where the universe came from. So instead of fantasizing about an elaborate series of spiritual beings in the Pleroma, he proposed a much simpler solution, and this will be a little easier for us to follow. He claimed that the God revealed in the Old Testament, Jehovah, or Yahweh, is not the same as the God revealed in the New Testament. I mean, has this heard this stuff before, some of you maybe? Okay, we've got two different deities here. The God of the New Testament, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, is the supreme Father over all. There is nothing higher than him. He is kind, he is benevolent, he is everything the scriptures say that he is. He is loving, he is caring. And he doesn't, this is where they depart from scripture, Marcion claimed that he doesn't really get all that bunged up about evil or sin. He just wants to love. He just wants to care for. He's just a really a good, benevolent, kind, compassionate deity. And under him is this inferior deity, the God of the Old Testament, known as Yahweh or Jehovah. And he is the one who made the world. And he did so, not for sure here, but Marcion proposed that he did so either out of ignorance or maybe just out of evil intent. But whatever the case, it's Jehovah that made the world, not the God of the New Testament. And this Jehovah in the Old Testament, he's impulsive, he's whimsical, he contradicts himself, he's vindictive, he's angry, he's jealous, he's demanding, he's capricious, he's insecure, and he's cruel. And he constantly keeps an account of those who disobey him, because he's eager to punish them. And Jehovah is the God of laws. He loves imposing unbearable laws on humans and beating them down with them. On the other hand, the Supreme Father, the God we read about in the New Testament, is not concerned about issues of justice or sin. Instead, again, his highest priority is to love us and to be loved by us. And obedience to him is not an issue. Sin doesn't really mean that much one way or the other. And out of compassion for us, the Supreme Father sent his Son to save us. So Christ in the plan of salvation was explained this way by Marcion. Jesus came to reveal the Supreme God, who until then had been the unknown Father. And in spite of his good and just life, Jehovah caused Jesus to be crucified. And Jehovah could not deny that in crucifying Jesus, who was sinless, he had broken his own Old Testament law. Like, oh no, what have I done? I should not have caused that to happen because Jesus was innocent. Now what do I do? So to right this wrong, he gives Jesus the souls of those who were to be redeemed. And therefore, in a certain kind of way, Christ purchased their salvation. Is that clever? Marcion had some pretty unorthodox views about Jesus. He was not born of Mary, since that would have made him subject to the Old Testament God Jehovah, who made Mary. Rather, Jesus just simply appeared suddenly on earth as a grown man and did so specifically in a synagogue in Capernaum in 29 AD. Not sure how he came up with all that. So it's kind of like beam me down, Scotty sort of thing. Marcion also taught that there would be no return of Jesus, no resurrection of the dead, and no restoration of the created world because, again, matter is evil. So another significant part of Marcionism, this is where we find this stuff very interesting for church history, is that the way that he deals with Old Testament scriptures, he says that they are inspired, but they are inspired by Jehovah, the bad God, and not inspired by the supreme good God. Therefore, anything in the Old Testament is not to be trusted. It's off limits, as well as any books in the New Testament that rely too much on the Old Testament. And in this, Marcion is actually the first person to compile a list of books to serve as a canon, you know, or New Testament books. You know, these would be a set of books recognized as the Word of God. He's the first one to do this. So up until this time, there's been no universally recognized list in the church. The earliest we have of a record comes 50 years later, called the Muratorian Canon, and around 200. And it's very close to what we have today, but it's just 22 books, not 27. So Marcion kind of like jumps the gun. He declares a list. It helps move the rest of the church along to kind of get these things settled. But those things don't really get settled until the early part of the 4th century. So Marcion's list included 10 letters of Paul and a mutilated version of Luke's gospel. What part of Luke's gospel would not be included in Marcion's what part of Luke's gospel would not be included?
Incarnation.
Yeah, the nativity scene. Yep. Yep. There are probably other things as well. And any positive reference to the Old Testament that might have been found in the other books, they were either eliminated or he would argue that they were the result of Judaizers who got in there and tampered them and edited them and inserted all these things at some point. All right, so the church strongly refuted and opposed his teachings, and in 144 he was excommunicated, and this is one of the earliest heretics to have been officially condemned by the early church. And as a response, he founded his own church in Rome, and then again he reached out in modern-day Turkey. And his doctrine of two gods found growing support, resulting in countless churches springing up all over the empire. It was an organized structure. It had its own bishops, its own schools, all sorts of things. And this heretical denomination lasted up until the 7th century. That's how much traction it got. And during the 2nd and 3rd centuries, it proved to be a formidable rival to the Orthodox Church. Small O, small C, Catholic Orthodox Church. All right, any questions about Marcionism? All right. Maybe I'll save Montanism for next week. Got a few pages on it. It's kind of interesting as well. Any questions about anything we've covered today? All right, so next week we'll pick up with Montanism, and then depending on how things go, we'll also look at early Trinitarian heresies. These are not necessarily movements, but teachers. They didn't really get any traction with movements following them, but their ideas persisted. We'll look at a number of the early church leaders, especially in the second century. And then we're going to talk about this heated debate over when to celebrate Easter and why that was so heated and what came of it. And if we have time, we'll look at the earliest version of the Apostles' Creed, how it came about, how churches were organized, and how churches worshipped in that time. Sounds like a lot, but a lot of those things we'll be able to cover quickly. All right, thank you. We'll see you. See you then.